Welcome to the Buyer's Desk, your weekly resource for all things natural food retail.
This season, we're shaking things up with shorter weekly episodes to fit your busy schedule.
Each month, we dive into SPINS data, explore trends with industry leaders, spotlight emerging brands, and share actionable strategies to help you thrive.
Get ready to explore the world of natural food retail.
Hey, folks, and welcome to the Buyer's Desk and Infra Podcast. I am Chris Sorensen.
And I'm Angela Bozo, and we are your hosts.
And today we're geeking out on two of our favorite topics, both merchandising and data. Specifically, we're going to dive into how you can use SPINS to measure the real impact of your promotions and promotional merchandising and your merchandising decisions that can either verify or dispel your buyer's gut instinct. So we'll definitely be talking sales lift using SPINS measures like incremental units and dollars, how to measure lift over prior period, lift over prior year, and all that good stuff that helps you figure out what's actually moving the needle in your store and how to make a more intentional, informed merchandising decision. Because let's be honest, Jim Wright, if you can't measure it, did it even really happen?
Right. I'm saying.
Yeah. So to walk us through how SPINS can support this work, we've brought in the expert himself, the sommelier of SPINS metrics, Senior Retail Insights Manager, Jim Olson. So Jim, take it away.
I won't run for the brick wall after hearing that kind of pump up. I love it. Thank you. Thanks for having me. And as you know, if you say data three times in one podcast episode, I'm automatically summoned. So I'm very happy to be here. Honestly, though, if we're going to get in the nitty gritty of using data to measure performance of a promotion, it's good to always have set a baseline to understand kind of what we're trying to measure and why. So obviously, not to speak down anybody, but you know, put an item on promotion is to entice more sales than the item might normally get. And to prove that you succeeded in this goal, you need data, right? You need to know your base price or the price from the item when not on promotion. And you need to know your base dollar and base unit sales for that item, which are those sales you'd normally see in absence or without a special promotional price. Again, super elementary. Do not mean to speak down to our audience, but just want to reinforce what those metrics are and their names so that when our wonderful users in our audience go into the SPINS, they can see those specific metric names and understand, you know, what they are and what they measure. But I'll pitch it back to you guys. You know, you have a lot more depth and breadth of in-store experience. When you were managing categories, did you have a hard set of numbers that you used to kind of track what your baseline sales were? Was it more of a gut feeling to kind of suss out what you could expect week over week or month over month? How did you guys approach it?
This is an excellent question. I think I'm going to give you the caveat here that I was the local buyer. And so on a lot of levels, my metrics were different than other category managers would be because part of, you know, the brand image of the store I worked for was all about having X percent local, making sure that we were supporting the local community. So whereas we did have promotional programming and we absolutely did capture movement, we had two different distinct sets of metrics depending on whether or not that product was already established in the marketplace, whether or not that product was fresh or non-perishable, and what we thought that that product could do kind of based on just like how much we liked it. Basically, it was a little bit arbitrary. Okay. So absolutely, we had some base measures, but I think that they were a little bit unique in the way that I looked at this. I mean, I could certainly speak to a more broader category management perspective and thinking about like, you know, I think on this podcast before I have recommended that you don't try anything for less than a 90-day period. And I think that that comes from a more traditional category management viewpoint. But yeah, I guess, Chris, I think your background might be slightly more traditional than mine if you want to talk about what you would look at.
Oh, well, maybe not, because I was a visual merchandising coordinator with the category management team. So I looked at things a lot through the promotional lens, both planning, you know, promotional end caps, but then looking at the performance of those after the fact. But we really just looked at, you know, these 2 weeks that we ran the promotion in, was it better than the 2 weeks prior? You know, so we looked at it, you know, were we able to sell more? And we looked at it through units, you know, dollars we also looked at too. But I think, you know, when I was working with the grocery buyers and category managers and like the grocery managers, we were looking like, how many cases do we go through? How many units do we go through? So we were looking a lot at, did we sell more stuff? So I think that was really important for us to look at and see, like, when we put two items together on an end cap, you know, one that sold really, really, really well, like a beverage with a bar that maybe was new or didn't sell well. Did we sell more of that bar that was paired with this beverage? So we tried to see, like, should we pair those items together? And so that's where we would look for performance, because I'd have grocery managers say, like, hey, this doesn't sell at my store, because we have three locations. So one grocery manager, like, these did great, or this, don't pair these things together anymore. And so we would look at the performance of, like, oh, that actually didn't perform well together. We should try pairing it with other stuff. But yeah, we wanted to make sure, were we putting things on end cap that were actually selling more than when they weren't on promotion? So it was very much a promotional off-shelf kind of view. We didn't really look at all promotions just on the shelf and how did they perform.
Interesting. So I would say I also came from a culture of the lobby display, and maybe that's a better grounding.
The foyer or the foyer?
Yeah, it could be either of those things. Absolutely. And I will also say that we had a number of locations, and so the lobby was more clear in some locations than others. Some it was like, oh, the wall to the right, right when you walk in, we're calling it the lobby. And so that would enable people to build case stacks. 100% of what needed to be in that lobby was on promotion and mostly in ad. I mean, occasionally there would be things that were not necessarily in ad, but our ads were also themed. So to your point about pairing things together, thinking about natural upselling adjacencies, it would look like that. But the limitation there, and I feel like this is interesting, but it was only 1 week because we were on a weekly ad cycle. So it was like every Wednesday, that lobby display gets refreshed based on sale items and thematic elements. And then it gets completely reset the previous Wednesday. Now, the data on doing something like that has to be relatively tight, because you do not want to be sitting on a bunch of cases of a product that didn't move. But also, that display has to be full the whole time. So it's a very interesting balancing act of, that's where you do the initial best promotional pricing, but you probably also have a promotional strategy to move that out of the lobby and then either back to an end cap, to your point, or there were some stores, depending on the square footage, would have places where we would build case stacks and they were known as promotional areas.
Well, that's where we get into the tactics of, like, dummying up a case stack. Like, you can pull the three bags in a case forward, and those bottom three, you know, look full, and your top ones can look full, and the ones in the middle, that's where you got your product. So I was the master of dummying up a case stack.
Well, where are you guys on that, actually, out of curiosity? Do you feel like an off-shelf display or an end cap always has to look incredibly full in order for it to be shopped? Yes.
Yes, always. It needs to be, like, people buy from abundance. Like, if you're like, here's a few things, I don't know, maybe it's cool, you should buy it. People are going to be like, well, especially in Minnesota here, like, I'm not going to take the last one, right? Yeah. But if it's abundant, right, if you're bringing in an abundance of product and just loading up the shelf, you're saying, this is a good deal, we're buying up on it, you, the shopper, you should buy this too. Like, if you run into a big, beautiful display, like, that sends that subliminal message of, like, this is a good thing. We brought it into the store, you should bring it into your house. That's what I've always taught and been taught.
That is what I've heard. I also, though, have heard like this other opinion that is, if a, let's say you're doing like the nesting tables and you have built this like very artistic, very almost architectural display of product, people are less likely to touch it because it looks like they're going to like disrupt a thing.
Yeah, but I think that's different than like just abundance itself. Yeah.
Truth.
Yeah, and I've built both. And yeah, I could say that to be true. And I built a giant Frankenstein out of kind boxes and called it Frankenkind, you know, but I took the bars out of the boxes and put it in baskets. Jim's sitting over here like, I should not have said, so I'm going to throw it back to you guys for merchandising. But yeah, I agree with that too. So to throw it back to you, Jim, since we've been kind of going back and forth here about the glory days of merchandising, when we're doing stuff like this, what are some other ways to, like, you know, we talked about like measuring over prior period and things like that. What are some ways when people are building displays like this, that whether it's the weekly, the bi-weekly, and moving things maybe from a front, I'm going to say foyer, that's what we called it, or I had one employee that said foyer, to an end cap, like, how do you measure the effectiveness, like, where it is in door or like for that time period? And like, how can people use spins to look into that a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, and no, you didn't lose me. I love hearing these war stories. My best retail experience comes from a lumber yard. So if the pallet of bags of cement was getting low, I had to move things forward. So not as pretty of a facing as anything you guys probably worked on. But Chris, you know, you mentioned just kind of looking at performance in general, say, you know, did we sell more, right? Is we did this action, as it feels bigger or smaller than it used to be, right? And then Angela spoke to about, you know, not wanting to have too much overstock either, right? Don't get things too bulging or things sitting on the shelf for forever. And that's where you can get a little bit deeper with data in general, and specifically with spins data, is going beyond those base metrics and measuring that success. You can keep it simple, like Chris said, like, did we sell more than before? Yes, thumbs up. No, sad face, right? But there's a lot of really valuable information that gets left on the cutting room floor if that's what you're limited to, right? And then for, you know, for a better picture of performance, you want to know incremental dollars and incremental units that are derived from the promotion. And incremental, these are the sales that you achieved above your expected baseline. So if you have a can of outside childhood playtime sparkling water, you know, you sell 5 cans in a week, keeping very, very elementary, right? And then you run a promotion and you sell 10 cans, right? Yes, sales doubled. That's fantastic, right? But it's also good to know, you know, if it's not sparkling water, if this is protein powders or more, you know, high value items, you know, what is that extra sales in terms of units, dollars too, but, you know, especially units over your expected baseline? What was that incremental value that you got back for that promotion? That helps you understand, number one, success, right? You sold more than you usually would. That's a win. But it also helps the, you know, from the buyer's perspective of not over ordering and having a lot of overstock that sits there. You know, if it's this frozen novelties, there's only so much space in the cooler, right? If it's something with longer shelf life, you may be okay, but you don't want to have overstock and things, you know, sitting there forever. And you also don't want understocked and have too few of an item that's selling really well, and now you've left a lot of potential, you know, dollars sitting there that never got to be achieved by your store. So having that knowledge of those incremental, and again, metrics widely available in spins for your perusing and enjoyment, to understand that true performance of how much extra did I get off this promotion.
Jim, I just had an aha moment from you talking about incremental lift in that way, or incremental units. You know, at Infra, you know, when people experience Infra deals, they use the promotions planner or the promotions portal, Infra Marketplace, all the things that it's called. And we tell people that, you know, that accounts for, and it kind of estimates what people are going to sell with usual demand. So usual demand is like what usually sell, like what you were saying. And then we say, you know, we need folks to go in there and give us the unusual demand, the things that you would not normally sell because you put it on end cap, but that's incremental, right? So if you were to go into spins and look at past sales of like what your incremental units were, could help you go into the promo portal and put your unusual demand. So I just made that connection now, and I was like, now I'm going to start helping members with that.
There you go. I mean, spins, we're here to help, right?
Yeah. Angela, you were going to mention something about incremental.
Not nearly as insightful. I was thinking, you know, it's interesting to think about how you define that previous period. Because, right, there are items, even non-perishable items, that we would consider more seasonal than others. So, Jim, I'm wondering, it just like broad strokes, do you think it can be more impactful to look back a solid year and compare seasonality depending on the category? Or do you think it's always more insightful to look back at like what is actually happening now, the previous couple of weeks in your store?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think it can go both ways. Might be category dependent. You know, if you want to see how those most recent promotions impacted store sales, you can look at your prior period, right? If you're looking at these current months, you can go against the previous month, say, you know, how much more did I get versus the last month? A nice, pretty simplified way of looking at it. But if, you know, the previous months had or didn't have big sales generating holiday. You think of 4th of July and the categories there. You think of obviously the fall, winter holidays. Sometimes you want to avoid or include that seasonality to keep it apples to apples, right? So if you're looking at ice cream sales in June, comparing them to May, at least in Minnesota, might not always be the best, but comparing them to June of last year, a lot more logical, a lot more fair of a comparison, right?
Yeah, whatever fair means. I mean, I think that actually, that's kind of an interesting way to think about it in terms of you could then decide to parse that data in the way that would make a promotion look potentially more successful, which I actually don't think that there's a problem with that. That can be very motivating for staff. That can be a really interesting way to look at it, right? Like if sales just happened to be fantastic in the last couple of weeks, but you were then to compare, let's say, June of 2025 to June of 2024, and it's like double digit lift at that point, you were carrying the same SKUs. I think that's equally impressive.
Yeah. And Jim, isn't there something with the incremental like units and dollar measure that doesn't it, what period of time does that account for? Because I at least thought that incremental did some sort of like estimate of like what you would have potentially sold if it were not on sale. What time period does that go for? A month, for 3 months, for 52 weeks? How does it calculate that baseline that you would have sold?
Yeah, so that ties into some of our pricing metrics as well. We have average retail price, which is kind of that in between, not going to be specific to what's on shelf in any given store, but that mix between that regular baseline price and a promotion price that might be detected and gives you that kind of middle median line. And so our system, our technology detects promotions that occur through within the past 8 week period. So for something that was priced at least 5% lower than the normal average price, that's considered a promotional price and a promotional item. So they can go against that. So using those baseline, those base metrics, those incremental metrics, you can kind of play off of that to understand, you know, how things are shaking out.
Okay, so that's pretty immediate. That's that like prior period, but a little bit more than just prior. It's prior period plus, you know, a little bit more. Okay. Cool. I think that's interesting for people to know if they're doing prior period versus incremental versus last year, that there's kind of that, that's kind of the bridge in between to give you a little bit more context.
Well, yeah. And I guess in the same way that the last time we chatted, I was like, is anybody doing a set where they're looking at these particular obscure attributes as they build a set? I'm going to ask another obscure question. Jim, have you ever worked with a member then that you then suggested that they run like a series of reports then to actually quantify what success means?
Yeah, I mean, please, as I mentioned in the last episode, reach out to me, call me, right? Happy to, it's fun to work on those projects, in more depth. A lot of that gets handled by our wonderful business advisor team, who are super well-versed and knowledgeable about that kind of thing. But yeah, there's fun ways to kind of mix and match the different SPINS reports available to our members to find that best information, whether you're looking at broadly across the total store overview, looking at current health and sales trajectories of categories or subcategories, going into specific items or brand level reports to see, you know, get the baseline of each of those on a normal week or month, what have you, so you can then kind of base against that. So a lot of short answer is there's a lot of answers and happy to work with you to help you track any campaign that you're about to work on.
So Jim, one thing I wanted to bring up about like end caps and displays that I go into stores and I see a handful of end caps that are just sets. People aren't using their end caps for promotional displays. And obviously, if you count for like the sales per that linear foot, right, for that 4 foot or 3 foot end cap, you generate a certain amount of sales within a period of time, whether you say a month or you could say 52 weeks. For those items that are like static on the end caps versus something that's like promotional where you can generate a lot of sales and a lot of excitement and a lot of units off of, usually tend to have a lot higher sales per that linear foot. So I always think about it from a space of like, is this set or these items like paying for their space? So how could someone use SPINS to understand maybe where do they have opportunities within their categories to either like shrink or grow categories to, let's say I wanted to take two or three of those end caps and make them promotional, but I need to find a place for this stuff to like live from this end cap into my like aisle runs. I know SPINS has some sort of way to help people like identify that. Can you dive into that just a little bit?
Yeah, that's a fun, complicated, but in a good, fun way. kind of lights up a certain part of my brain, right? You know, one thing that could be very helpful is looking at, your top selling items, which you probably have a good, again, gut feeling on, who are my big drivers, my big cash cows, going back to college education, but looking not only at those sales, we know your top performers, but then what's their share of sales, right? For a certain brand, if it's sparkling water, you know, here's my X brand, all the different flavors. You know, what percent is my share of brand X to the total sparkling water category? How important is this brand to my overall set? You know, they're really driving or not as much. Understanding share of subcategory, share of category, share of department, if you want to go more broad, that's a fun way you can look at to say like, what's the, you know, how much value is this to my larger category and success? Because that's, you know, that's kind of the point of promotions, right? Drive incremental sales for the category at large.
I think when I've gone into like the independent retailer reports, there's a report, I think it's like the first one you go to, and that can give you some insight into like categories that are growing, declining, and show, what is that report called? I always forget.
Yeah, that's the total store overview. And it's, as you mentioned, it's a really great way to kind of get a quick net cast out to say, all right, looking broadly at, you know, departments across the store, you know, what are some areas that are a little soft I can look into? From there, going down to category and even subcategory level, and say, you know, how are sales compared to last year or prior period? What's the share? You know, some metrics open like share. You know, if you're looking at functional beverages, you can look at kombucha specifically and like how much is kombucha driving sales of all functional beverages compared to all grocery or kind of broader. I can kind of build up from there. You could add in some other metrics, you know, average retail price and say, you know, is overall, you know, as an aggregate, is my category overpriced compared to categories in the broader channel in my region? You could bring in average number items selling to get a rough SKU count to say, like, am I really over skewed here? You know, I'm overselling, but, you know, my competition or the larger region is not that far behind me. You know, sales were up 8%, but the region's up 5%. And they have like half the amount of SKUs on average that I do. So can I still be competitive while clearing up shelf space? So yeah, to your point, I love that report. You can find so much good information without even getting to item level detail, you know, looking at specific SKUs. You can get such a good understanding of your landscape before you take those second and third steps.
Awesome. That's great. Yeah, I think that helps people identify where those opportunities are to, like, if you have sets that are like not driving the sales, you can shrink some of those sets, integrate that end cap product that's stationary into those aisles, and then now you got a promotional end cap.
That's so interesting to me, just how many ways you could look at that, right? Like, I could look at a category, I could look at a subcategory, I could look at a brand, and then theoretically I could look at a SKU, right? I mean, and I wonder too, I was actually thinking, like, if I looked at a brand piece, that could be unnecessarily skewed by poor, like, particular SKUs in that brand that don't sell well, but you could still have like a hero item. I was just kind of thinking about all the different ways that data could be somewhat limiting. And again, like, for me today, it's just all about, like, I could run 3 spins reports and that would make me feel like I had looked at the complete picture of this question. And so I love that you can do that. And I like thinking about, like, oh, if I did it this way, it wouldn't quite be like the full picture. So, like, yeah, I just thought, wow, that's fascinating. You know, like, I've got this one SKU of kombucha, but the rest of the line is garbage. And if I didn't pay attention, like, to SKU level data, I would miss that if I felt like I aggregated the brand and it went poorly. So anyway, just, you know, running my own store in my head.
Yeah, well, I think that that comes back down to context, right? It's like you kind of look at things at a broad level to identify like where opportunities are, but then you have to dive in to some of that data and drill through to see, like, oh, what is, you know, where are these items performing well or not? And then you have to make that decision, because what if you drill in and those are all local items, right? And then it's like, no, those are actually something that are part of our mission that, like, puts forward our values. We are not going to shrink that set. We actually want that for that reason. And that's okay that it's not performing that way. So yeah, I think this comes back to, we've talked about this before, like, you can't just be all data driven. You should be data informed, right? And data informed is like, you have your real world context, you know, when the snowstorms have happened, and that's why sales weren't good at that last period, or a holiday is coming up, or what's all the context that the data doesn't have. So I think, to your point, it's fascinating to be able to run all these reports, but you also have to use the data and your gut and, like, all those things that you know.
All right. So let me ask you this. I'm building an end cap. I am going to put only 2 brands on this end cap. They're both at a really great discount. Within both of the brands I'm looking at, I have some exceptional sellers and I have some slow movers. There's a lot of ways you could look at that, right? Like, gut check, tell me how to build this end cap.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of schools of thought. Some people are like, I don't put the slow sellers on the end cap.
but they need to have a chance, right? Why aren't we giving them a chance? They're on sale. Okay.
I mean, there's a little bit of a hybrid of that, right? Like if there's 10 SKUs in the line, you're probably not wanting to put all 10 SKUs on, right? You do want to pick like your top 3 to 5, right? But even your two sellers that sell like 10,000 a year, and then you have three others that sell 2,500 a year, I pack out the ones that sell more, right? So if you think about unit sales, what item actually sells, I would give, and I like vertical striping. So if we're thinking these two brands, I'm going to say it's Late July and Nixie, just because, you know, Nicole Doss started both brands, and I'm going to put them on an end cap, and I'm going to do the Late July restaurant chip. So I'm going to do the sea salt lime, and then the chia and quinoa. The chia and quinoa did not sell well. So maybe I'll just do one stripe down the middle of the chia and quinoa, and then I'll do like two facings of the sea salt to the right and the two facings of the sea salt lime to the left of that. So I'm giving double pack out to the two that sell 10,000 a year, and the one that sells, you know, less than half, I'm giving one facing. So that's a way where you can put something out. The things that sell well are packed out. It sells more. At the end of the sales period, you're putting less of the item that sells least in your back room. And if you have any left over at the end, the items that actually sell well throughout the year, well, at regular price, you have more good back stock that you're selling through. That's how I would approach that. And then same with Nixie being in the middle, right? I would take the one that sells the best and give it a few more facings and maybe drop off the one SKU that really doesn't make the cut. That's how I would approach it.
So in your scenario, you're giving one SKU in each line a shot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would definitely give it less space though. And if you don't like vertical striping, you know, give that chia and quinoa one shelf at eye level to try to pick up some sales, and then give two shelves up above of your sea salt and like three shelves down below of sea salt lime, right? You can do that same approach in multiple different ways. I just like a vertical stripe because you can shop and control your inventory better.
Okay. So chia and quinoa or X SKU that was given the shot on the end cap did not perform based on promotional activity on this line in other instances, in other end caps, or in other incremental sales periods, do I disco it post a promotion?
If it's doing that over and over and over again, I mean, I wouldn't make any decisions based on one point in time, right? That's just like one data point. And I think Jim would probably back me up, is that you'd want to see trends over time. But I'd let Jim speak to trends.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's good. Good at fighting shot. Overall, I like Chris's approach. It's like the merchandising version of that Paul Wellstone quote, right? We all do better when we all do better. We all sell better when we all sell better. So give it a good shot. I mean, just like our wonderful new AB ad cycle here at Infra, right? Things take time for customers to adapt and adjust, for the retailers themselves to adapt and adjust and you know, give things a good fair shot. So after 2 weeks, it's not enough of a sample size, right? You need to let go a couple months in to make sure things are performing as well as they can. And if not, you know, then yeah, you can disco. You can go to Spins, look at your items not selling report, find some good void opportunities for some great replacement swap-ins that are performing well outside your store. But give it a good shot.
Awesome. I think this has been a great conversation. I could talk another 30 minutes with you guys about merchandising and data. Appreciate both of your guys' time talking about data and merchandising. And we have three more episodes coming out where we're going to keep continuing to talk about merchandising and data in a bunch of different ways through Fresh, with some of our promotions and merchandising advisory team. So I'm excited to continue this conversation as the month proceeds.
Absolutely. Always great to see both of you. And Jim, thank you so much for your time, for always bringing your data, your insight, and this time, you know, bringing all things incremental.
Love it. Happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, everyone. I'm Haley Craig, Events and Education Specialist here at Infra.
And I'm Madeline Ware, Marketing and Communications Specialist. In celebration of Infra's 20th anniversary, we're interviewing 20 Infra members about what fuels their passion for the natural foods industry, the challenges they've overcome, and what advice they have for budding small business owners.
This month, we're sitting down with Emily Cantor, second-generation owner of Cambridge Naturals, and Dan Stump, store manager at Leg Up Farmers Market.
Hear from Emily Cantor about her journey in taking over her family's business, advice she has for other second-generation owners, and her experience serving as an Infra board member.
And learn more about Leg Up Farmers Market's unique business model, which serves children and adults with special needs through their multiple therapy centers. We'll also hear from Dan about how he prioritizes educating customers on healthy eating and shopping locally.
Here's a sneak preview of our episode with Cambridge Naturals.
Coming in with an outside perspective gave me, I think, a unique ability to look at it not just as like a part of me or, you know, like, or even my child, but actually like something on its own that I want to nurture and care for and have it grow, but not, you know, so attached to me or like my soul or my, you know, understanding of who I am. And so I think that's also been really invaluable for me, you know, is just like that slight detachment that I feel from it in comparison to, I think, the way my parents felt for many years.
We can't wait to share these conversations with you. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
As we wrap up this episode of The Buyer's Desk, we'd like to extend our heartfelt thanks to the incredible infra staff, contributors, dedicated independent retailers, and visionary natural food brands and business partners that made this episode possible.
Stay tuned for more inspiring insights and stories in the world of natural food retail. Until next time, thank you for your support. Angela Bozo, co-host and administrator.
Chris Sorensen, co-host and producer.
Kim Rout, executive producer and segment contributor.
Jim Olson, Spin's segment manager.
Austin Hinkle, audio engineer.
Sarah Super, wellness strategist.
Madeline Ware, marketing writer, editor, and digital manager.
Haley Craig, outreach manager.
Raina Kittredge, segment contributor.